This is the 20th season of the Consumed podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Lewis. And this time around, I'm doing a quick retrospective with clips from the over 200 conversations I've had with eaters, drinkers, thinkers, and makers. I certainly can't include clips from all of them, so I stuck with the moments that have stuck with me over the last 5 years. I categorize them by the different kinds of guests I've had, so it's a great way for devoted listeners to look back or for casual listeners to dip in. I have so enjoyed reliving these moments, and I hope you will too. But first, a quick shout out to the Consumed podcast sponsors. Consumed is sponsored by Slow Life Magazine. Slow Life offers a wealth of information about what makes San Luis Obispo tick, from in-depth profiles of locals to features on homes in the area, stories about local bands and music, and a column about area restaurants written by yours truly. For the next issue of Slow Life, I covered the beautiful food and culture that Sarah, Pedro, and Chencho have cultivated at Corazon Cafe in downtown San Luis Obispo. The magazine publishes every other month, so look for it in your mailbox, pick up your copy at Boo Boo Records, or sign up for a subscription at slowlifemagazine.com. We all know eating fruits and veggies is an important part of staying healthy. Fresh, local produce has the most flavor and nutrition, but how do you know what's in season locally? Become part of the Tally community as a member of the Tally Farms Box program. Tally grows their produce and partners with other California farmers to include the freshest and best tasting local produce you can find anywhere. Farming on the Central Coast since 1948, the Tally family created the Tally Farms Box to make healthy eating easy and affordable. Here's how it works. Select which size box you want, then choose pickup or home delivery and how often you want to get your box. It's flexible for customization and vacation holds, and included in all boxes are tested recipes and storage recommendations. Come be a part of Tally's healthy lifestyle. Visit tallyfarmsbox.com and use promo code CONSUMED for $10 off your first box. That's promo code CONSUMED for $10 off. Eat fresh, eat local, and eat lots of California fruits and veggies for better health. Okay, don't let the category of these episodes fool you. I'm calling it miscellaneous, but the truth is they're so incredibly special to me. When I tell people I have a podcast about food and drink, I always say, hey, it's not just chefs and winemakers. It's like food banks and environmentalists and advocates for farm workers, even theologians. Anyway, here's the miscellaneous episode with clips from interviews that left me both fulfilled and full of curiosity. Sandy Sigurdsson was once my boss. That's how we met, working at a nonprofit together. But now she's my very dear friend. She's also a leader in the community. In fact, she won Person of the Year at the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce annual dinner earlier this year. And she's a recovering alcoholic. I really wanted to get Sandy on the mic to talk about her experience coming to terms with her alcoholism. And from the moment she said yes, I knew it would be special. In this clip, she opens up about how it all started for her.
Bottom line, I was the kind of drunk that all I really wanted to do was not be here and now. Mm-hmm. And so I could ball up my hands and grit my teeth and get through the day and like pretend to be a normal human. Because I knew what normal humans, what normal good wives, normal good moms, I knew the kind of stuff they did. And so I did all that. But then there was just like this ferocious me time that would come on at about 8:30 at night. That was
me
like,
time, not good me time.
Oh, not good me time. Oh, no. That was just, okay, people, have I checked off all your boxes? Did I do everything right? Am I good enough yet? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, slam whatever, usually cheap wine mm-hmm. that was around.
Where does that come from? You may not be able to say, but I'm thinking like, is it a genetic thing or is it, when you were born, did you come out wanting to check out? Do you remember as a kid feeling like that?
Well, I started drinking, and this is a very common time and age. I started drinking at age 12. Mm-hmm. And my folks were big drinkers. That was a, you know, madman time.
It was a cultural thing.
Oh,
yeah.
Crikey. Yeah. Crikey. So they bought, you know, bourbon by the gallon. I don't think they had wine in a box at that time. Wine wasn't really a thing.
Yeah.
Maybe port.
Cocktails.
Or
sherry.
Sherry.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, they wouldn't, and they drank enough between the two of them that they didn't notice. And listen, don't get me wrong. I had a great upbringing. We traveled. I was the oldest of five. I had a stay-home mom.
A lot of love, I know.
Lots and lots of love.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of love. And alcohol was just a big part of the culture because alcohol is a big part of the culture. That part hasn't changed much at all.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But you've seen it maybe take different shapes.
Well, there's a level of sophistication and acceptance that's there. Mm-hmm. And perhaps it was there before. I can kind of picture some woman with a bob and a shirtwaist dressed, holding a cigarette in one hand and a martini glass in the other. But, you know, yeah, you know, we live in wine country. And and that's alcoholism among women over the age of 40, a dissatisfaction with life is pretty strong. I wish I could remember, you know, the Women's Legacy Fund a few years ago did a study that I remember Marty Claus was part of it, and I wish I could remember the other. Robin Letters, Marty Claus and Robin Letters, they were very involved. And they just, the revelation of women who consider themselves to have a drinking problem, self-identified.
Is it low or is it
high?
Oh,
it was super high. It was way out of, much higher than any of the other counties in the state.
Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt is a well-loved and well-respected professor of religious studies at Cal Poly State University in San Luis Obispo. He's also a wine lover and authored the books The Spirit of Wine, Finding Religion in the Fruit of the Vine, and The Spirit of Winemakers, Finding Religion from the Vineyard to the Bottle. When we met for the podcast, I told him about what felt like a religious experience for me with a glass of Spätlese Riesling at a tasting years ago. I'd had something like 30 wines already that day and dutifully spat each one, but this Riesling would not let me. It took me by surprise and demanded my full attention, so I sipped and swallowed it with reverence. That's what he's responding to here in this clip.
What spurs religion on is not the theologians, but the mystics. The theologians want to explain God. The mystics want to convey the experience of God. Mm. And the only way to do that has been through paradox, through poetry, through eroticism, through, I mean, all these things, because language falls short. And also I love that story for you because it also shows that when almost every religious person I've talked to, I said, yeah, how did you become a monk? You know, when did you just change that? You know, when did you choose that? And almost to a person, they said, I never chose that. Mm. Somehow it was chosen for me. Mm-hmm. That I can remember the moment where I realized that this is not something I necessarily want to do, but it just came upon me. Mm-hmm. In the same way where you were like, I didn't, you know, I'd been spitting, but I couldn't. And that's
the
thing.
It's not like I prepared myself. Oh, we're going to taste the Spätlese. And no, it happened.
Yeah. And that's the thing is I think the experience is, and especially if you're one who loves control and loves organization.
Not at all.
You know, if someone's like that and then they confront a wine where they realize that the universe has conspired to blow that up in their head and they have to give up. That's the experience that countless mystics over the years have talked about.
My talk with Arsenio J. Lopez is one I often think of as critical to the heart of the Consume podcast. Arsenio is a Mixteco native from a village in Oaxaca, Mexico, and he came to the States to work in Oxnard strawberry fields in 2003. Over the years, he moved from being a field worker to a community organizer with the Mixteco Indigena Community Organizing Project, or MICOP, which supports and empowers the indigenous migrant communities on California's Central Coast. When we were together, he shared the truth about where our food comes from, the vibrant community that plants, protects, harvests, and packs much of the produce that we eat. It brought up a mix of emotions in me, grief, joy, and confusion, and I'll never forget it.
Every time we sit in our tables with our families and we have, you know, that salad, of lettuce.
Of course, the greens. Yeah.
All these greens. Probably sometimes or oftentimes we don't ask ourselves like, what hands, like how that those individuals, those hands that they were picking up those and make that possible in our tables. How is their lives? Mm-hmm. Do they have also food, you know, healthy food for themselves and their families? Have they been treated with dignity? Mm-hmm. You know, have been them, their working conditions have been in the conditions that is like human conditions, mm-hmm. where we often see us from this side, you know, being from these communities and be the advocates as the organizations where I work, every day I see a lot of injustice of these people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When there is like heat strike, you know, people are dying in our fields, picking up your strawberry, picking up your grapes. People are dying. Mm-hmm. There, we have cases of teens, you know, 18 years old, 16 years old, 18 years old girls who die from heat stroke. People not having clean waters to drink, or they don't have shadow, even though there is all these laws that protects, quote unquote, protects workers.
Yeah.
But what is really lacking is that enforcement system. Like, who is there to enforce that,
you know? And protect them.
And protect them, right? So I think we need to like be more curious to know and just be more like inviting people to know that system, how that thing works, who is working there. We see teens working in agriculture on the fields, mm-hmm. and have to like give their education dreams gave up, you know, for example.
Yeah. I went to high school with people who only went to say 10th grade, and then we didn't see them anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it might sound very strong, but I think that we have one of the things I always say, that we are in a system that is very hypocritical. Because here you are. You are just in the middle of the pandemic, right? We're telling the farm workers, workforce, these workers saying they're essential workers.
Yeah, right.
They're essential workers. That's so important, because without them, we will not have, you know, the food. So imagine these people every day have to take the risk, mm-hmm. you know, when the pandemic started, have to take the risk to decide either stay home and trying to be safe for the next month, which you're not going to complete for your rent, or you're not going to have enough, you know, funds or money for your food,
whatever. Yeah.
Or you have to take that risk, mm-hmm. you know, and go in and do the work. So this country has food.
Yeah.
And that's risking their own lives and risking their family's life,
yeah.
you know, because transportation sometimes has been a problem. The work conditions doesn't allow that 6 feet distance, or employers were not providing the basic equipments, the PPE, you mm-hmm. know, equipments for them to protect themselves, hand sanitizers, face masks.
Like basic stuff.
Basic stuff.
Yeah.
We as an organization had to pull our resources to be there doing the outreach and handling those materials to these workers, mm-hmm. you know, and them appreciating that. So we're calling them essential workers, but they don't have the essential things for their own health and for their own families.
Yeah. Here's another conversation about where our food comes from, and it's equally challenging. Dr. David Cleveland is a renowned research professor with the Environmental Studies Program and Department of Geography at UC Santa Barbara. And through the course of examining the local food system with his students, he discovered something that has since been coined the Santa Barbara Syndrome, in which 99% of the food grown in Santa Barbara County is shipped outside the county, and just 1% stays, and whatever other local food Santa Barbara County consumes has been shipped to a distribution center in Southern California or Nevada, and then shipped back. His pursuit to understand this convoluted food system began when the mudslides in Montecito shut down all traffic on Highway 101, as well as all rail cargo. But the abundance of Santa Barbara County, one of the richest agricultural places in the world, did not show up on grocery store shelves. What I understand the Santa Barbara Syndrome to be is that 99% of Santa Barbara County produce that's grown here is shipped away, mm-hmm. sent away. 1% stays, and that's what's for Santa Barbara Countyans to consume.
And that's about 5% of what we consume. So that 1% that's not shipped out is 5% of what we eat in Santa Barbara
in
County.
In total, okay.
And which is, you know, which is what, as I told you, what most people focused on, and, you know, the reporters focused on was this incredible disparity between what's right there mm-hmm. and why aren't we eating that?
Mm-hmm. And that's what you mean by localized.
Yeah, that's what I mean by, we did find some cases, for example, not many, but there were, I think it was one of the chain grocery stores, Safeway, or one mm-hmm. of those. And we, my students and I, we interviewed or we had data, for example, Sam Edelman from the Santa Barbara County's Certified Farmers Markets shared his data with us, so we knew he let us have the data on how much was actually sold at the farmers markets. Yeah. UCSB Dining shared all their data because they're a large food purchaser on mm-hmm. how much was from Santa Barbara County. We interviewed Blueberry, we scoured Santa Barbara. We went to places in Santa Maria, other small grocery stores, and we talked to managers and tried to actually find out what are the numbers here. And one of the, as I said, one of the chain grocery stores said, "Oh yeah, we sell local avocados and lemons or something like that." Right. We said, "That's great." And then that was kind of an anomaly because none of the other stores, and we said, well, we need to check that again. So we went back to talk to the produce manager, and it turns out that, yes, some of the avocados and lemons they sell were grown in Santa Barbara County, but they were first shipped to a distribution center. I think it was in Reno or someplace.
Sure.
And then shipped back to the store. So we didn't consider that local because...
Well, no.
It was a very small amount, and it was shipped out and shipped in our, anyway, so.
Well, I mean, I suppose it does benefit that local farmer. In that way, it's local. But I also wonder about, are they getting paid their fair amount?
Yeah.
When all of this cost is being put into shipping it away and bringing it back.
Storing it someplace and then shipping it back. And yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And farmers, you know, when I talk to farmers about this, in subsequent research, and they said, "Oh yeah, they didn't know exactly, but they said, yeah, we know this happens because, you know, like when the mudslides close 101 and the train, and we can't get some of the stuff we grow out, we went to the local grocery stores, the chain stores, and said, look, we've got this, we've got broccoli, we've got lemons, we've got
lettuce. But they couldn't accept it, could they?
And they said, no, we can't buy it from you. That's not our. We just can't do that. It's not feasible for us. With our corporate management, we can't do it. So the food was spoiling here because they couldn't. And people were going to the stores and they were empty. And so there's the economic system, huge market failure.
There's something wrong there. Yes, for sure. Ariana Lovato of Honeycomb Home Design in Arroyo Grande, California, did all the design work for me and my husband, Jake, when we needed to renovate our kitchen, and she's remarkably good at what she does. While the kitchen itself turned out beautifully, it's the fact that our marriage came out intact on the other side of the project that's really worth celebrating. We credit much of this to Ariana's presentation, expertise, and gentle guidance. In this clip, Ariana and I talk in broad generalities about how she does her job while taking couples' different styles into account.
Most of the times, the husband will say, well, make my wife happy, you know, happy wife, happy life, or whatever. But the husband always has an opinion, too. And so we are like very, I used to not do this, but now it's a must when I go to a consultation. Both decision makers are there.
Smart.
Whether it's additional family members, maybe your mother-in-law is living with you guys, like who is actually going to use the space day in and day out? I need to talk to them. Mm-hmm. And are they shorter? Are they taller? Like just things that you wouldn't normally think about, but ways that we can improve the way that they use the kitchen. I need to talk to them to know that.
Yeah.
And so between a spouse, usually it's comes down to like budget, just most often.
No, I know.
Like,
I
mean, you know, like somebody wants to spend more, and it's not always the husband doesn't want to spend, you know, the wife could be the more frugal one, and the husband's like, let's do it, you know. So I'm always just trying to get to the core of like, okay, what is the end result here? What do you guys really want? And what's the vision? And how can I bring that to life?
Yep. Yeah. For us, I mean, yes, budget was for sure an issue because there was only so much, you know, like there was an end to the money. But also Jake tends to be more function oriented and I'm far more form oriented. So it can be actually a really good partnership.
Yeah.
But it helped to have you there to talk to both of us and, you know, in your very diplomatic way, come to some kind of a center point on those.
Yeah. Like what is, I don't know. And it's so much of designing is, I don't know the right word, but you have to read between the lines and like look at people's body language and the way that, you know, they could be nodding and agreeing with you, but then their body language says otherwise. And so it's like, okay, well, let's talk about that for a second. Yeah. Like, why do you not like that particular color? You know, like I know Jake really wanted a gray kitchen.
Yeah.
You wanted a white kitchen.
You remember.
It's a gray kitchen. It's beautiful. I mean, it's awesome.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's totally beautiful.
But
we had to come to some kind of a compromise.
That was the thing, you know? And so, so it's just kind of navigating through that. And it's ultimately like the client's responsibility to talk amongst themselves of like, okay, how do we want to get from point A to point B? I can only get you there by persuading you or telling you the pros and the cons.
Like just about everyone I know, the subject of waste from the kitchen and anywhere else is confusing and guilt-inducing. Is it still safe to eat? Is it compostable, recyclable, reusable? Do I have to wash it first? When I look at a used tea bag, do I need to remove the staple on the tag first? It's enough to make a home cook crazy. But I had read that my home county of San Luis Obispo is a leader when it comes to managing waste. In fact, we're the first place in America to use an anaerobic digestion facility to process organic waste, which is pretty cool. To understand all this and to ask all my burning questions about trash, I invited the executive director of the San Luis Obispo County Waste Management Authority, Peter Cron, on the podcast. And I cannot recommend listening to this whole episode enough. It's just fascinating. For a taste of it, here's Peter discussing the story behind plastics and that deceptive little recycling icon we see everywhere.
Everybody wants to do the right thing. And so the goal is to just demonstrate what is the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, people are confused. You get a plastic, you know, glass or cup or bottle or any number of things, and they've got those little chasing arrow symbols on the bottom.
Yes.
Automatically, people think those are recyclable.
Totally.
Well, that was a marketing campaign done by the American Chemistry Council to help market plastics, saying that they're always recyclable. Now, mind you, a lot of plastics are recyclable.
Okay.
But they're not, it's just not feasible. It's not financially viable to recycle some of these plastics. Because, with the way they come in or the resins they're made out of. I can't remember the law that just passed, but it's going to require that if you can't physically recycle it in that community, they can no longer put that symbol on that.
You're blowing my mind because when was that campaign? Was it in the 80s?
Oh, that was, it was in the 80s or 90s when plastics started to really run. I remember, another job I had, I worked for, the industry that built equipment for the soft drink industries.
Okay.
And I remember when PET plastic first came in to play as the plastic soda bottles versus the glass soda bottles.
Yes, yes.
The people that in the glass plants were saying that plastic was never going to be here to stay, that glass will always be the way it's going to go because plastic has some shortcomings. Well, you know, economics drove it to plastic because plastic's a one-way package. Mm. Plastic's light to transport.
It's lighter.
Yeah, I mean, there was a number of different reasons to utilize it. Mm. It wasn't, you didn't break it when you dropped it.
Yeah.
But here we are now, I hate to say this, but almost 40 years later, where we're looking at plastics and now all of a sudden we've got, you know, gyres floating in the Pacific and in the South Pacific.
What's
and
a gyre?
It's a swirl of plastic.
Oh,
it's
like a flotilla kind
yeah,
of?
Yeah, kind okay. of like things the size of Texas that are actually floating out there that are just big plastic garbage patches. Oh. Because, you know, plastic seemed like a good idea at the time.
It's like margarine, right?
Right, exactly.
Thank God for margarine.
Right, yeah, all these, yeah. So
it's
all
plant-based.
All these, yeah, right. Right. It goes in the digester fine. But anyway, so we, the unintended consequences of our lives. So these are things we do we thought were convenient. We thought they were going to save us. We thought they were going to be better. And turns out they're just not.
When I grow up, I want to be Sister Teresa Harpin, the founder and executive director of a San Luis Obispo organization called Restorative Partners, which helps people move from inside the justice system to outside it. I interviewed her in 2023, just after the opening of the Bridge Cafe, a restaurant in downtown SLO that's managed by Restorative Partners, and which feeds the community beautiful breakfast and lunch while also providing culinary training and employment for people who have previously been incarcerated. In this clip, she talks about the special way the Bridge Cafe came to fruition after years of waiting.
I watched men coming out of jail who were all certified to work in restaurants and couldn't get jobs.
They were certified because of, like, doing food service in the jail?
Correct. Okay. While they were incarcerated, they had many months, sometimes years. They got their safe serve and serve management and all this. But because of their criminal background, had a hard time getting a job. Mm-hmm. Now, some of that has shifted in these days, but that stayed with me. It stayed with me the way the same question stayed with my mentor, Father Greg Boyle, the founder of Homeboy Industries.
I know. I'm like, wait, Father Greg Boyle.
Yes.
He is your mentor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We've, of course, read his book.
Yes.
Oh,
Tattoos
my.
Tattoos on the Heart.
Gosh,
yes.
What a wonderful. This is so great. Love it.
Okay. So he's mentored me among other people, but he had the same feeling. Doggone it, these employers aren't going to give our people a chance. I'm going to start my own social enterprises.
Yep.
And that's what moved him. So I felt that way about food.
Yes.
I said, we're a tourist town. We're a college town. I mean, hospitality industry is
everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
So what could we do? And then it intensified with COVID because all these people lost jobs and restaurants went down. I said, this is good for both. So the opportunity came, and I won't go into the whole history, but I've been coveting the Bridge Cafe place for years, but it was under other ownership. Yeah. I had a one crack at it about 5 years ago. It didn't pan out.
I knew that this was a long time in coming. I think I read somewhere that how many years in the
process? I would say
process?
8 to 10 years I've been dreaming about.
So
this.
Even 5 years ago, you wanted it, couldn't have it.
Couldn't have it. Wasn't the right time. Mm-hmm. The investment was too big. And so, but I always tucked it away in my heart. And we were actively then looking for someplace in this when COVID happened in the next year, pretty 2021. Mm-hmm. And we were looking all around and this became available. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh my gosh, could it be what I have been seeking and thinking about and a good place for a nonprofit, especially ours and our mission?
Yes.
So we did a business plan quickly. We submitted it to the county because they have to approve it, the real property office. But lo and behold, someone put theirs in just before us.
Oh, shoot.
And so we had to reseed again because they would only entertain one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I remember the summer of July 4th, 2021, I took a walk on Pismo Beach and I said, you know, God, what do you want? We thought this was it, and it doesn't seem to be, but I'll trust you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a mystery, but I'll trust you anyway. I got a phone call while I'm walking on the beach. The buyers fell out. Do you still want it, sister? And I said, of course, but I better call my board president. And
well, there is that, yes.
So we did. Everybody said, we already gave you the go. Go for it.
That's it for this quick stroll down memory lane on the Consumed podcast. To hear these interviews and many others, head to letsgetconsumed.com where you can search and peruse episodes, see photos, and get recipes. You can also sign up for the Consumed newsletter list, which offers updates on the podcast, more recipes, and even more than that. Special thanks to Chris Lambert for doing the original editing on all these episodes, and to Alexandra Wallace for the lovely collage celebrating the 20th season. Until next time, I'm Jamie Lewis.